hospitality basket, what I got here. You know that's encouraging to a preacher. When he comes in, he's tired and just hostile and all that, and you see something really nice, like they had a lot of products in there that had to do with soap. And most of you hadn't even met me yet. But I'll keep it. I'll keep it. I want to thank these godly elders and Brother Allen. I want to thank you for a lot of notes, words of encouragement. I have a great big board at home. I know, in fact, I have a room at home now. And in this room, I have all the cards and all the drawings from adults and children. I have all these notes of encouragement. I have all these things that have meant so much to me over the years that I preached, and I plan to carry the memory of those into eternity. What a nice thing to have to remember. And this will be one of them right here. I deeply appreciate it. You don't know what this week has meant to me, being where I'm from almost. Just missed it by about 20-something miles. I want to do this abbreviated version, and I'll do it really fast. I want to talk a little about the future of Islam, because they cannot continue to blame the West for all of their ills. Before they can make any appreciable progress and rid themselves of their living in the past chest-thumping ignorance, they have to get their own house in order. They're very, very good, and I'll say this as a general statement, about criticizing what everybody else is not doing right. But they need to get their own house in order, because they've been fighting for hundreds and hundreds of years. Without a reformation in the practice of Islam that moves it forward instead of backwards, there's a little hope for Muslims anywhere. Today, Muslims are in the middle of a vital point in their history, and they can alone decide what way forward they have. In the early part of the 21st century, Islam's advancing toward this defining moment along several routes, and one of them is violence. And once they start the violence, then we don't have any recourse but to respond. And that is not in any sense endorsing the tenets of Islam. But today, American mosques, for example, and advocacy groups, which are all over the place, whose representatives are most commonly called on by the media. Why? Because they look religious. And they usually call on the people who are least able to give a definitive view, an accurate view of what Islam really is. And they reflect the views of only a small part of the American Muslim community. Of the 2 million Muslims that attend out of the 6 million, that makes about 25%, that attend worship service at least once a year. Of those, just to 411,060, less than this 25%, attend mosque regularly. And before we get too comfortable again, does this remind us of the majority of home-based Americans who consider themselves faithful brethren? And they show up maybe one or two times a month. They could not tell you the last time that they were at all the services of the Lord's church for 1 month, starting with the first of July. See if you can attend every service of the Lord's church up to the last day of July. I know July the 4th is in there. But see if you can do that. It's harder than you think. It's harder than you think to do. Most of America's self-professed Muslims calling themselves the voice of Islam are so far removed from a Middle Eastern worshipful mindset as to consider themselves almost fallen away. I have been trying for years to get a definition for who they are. The ones that are, quote, like us. They want to pay for their hospitalization for their children, educate their children, pay the taxes and payments on their homes. They want to be like us. So I guess you would call those moderate Muslims. The problem is, if you look at the Quran even as a cursory look, if you will look at the Quran, you will see there's no such thing as a moderate Muslim, because they're told specifically what they must do in order to dominate the world. It's not about cooperation, it's about domination. And if they do something that's sort of moderate, well, they're the fellow next door, they're the fellow that I've talked across the back fence with or at work, and he is a Muslim, then he's either not a Muslim or he has to be a full-blown Muslim. And in that case, I haven't seen very many in my life. I haven't. Islam grows in the United States because its Muslim followers believe it, they're willing to work at it, and they're willing to bring others into it. And that is so sad to me, because as I mentioned before, they are made in the image of God, just as are we. They are part of that group that in the Great Commission tells us that we're to go and teach. Well, Bert, they won't let us. I have an idea that we will find ways to do it if we're really interested in doing it. And the first part is what we're doing right now with some of their young people coming this way. Because I already know that a lot of them that I've met that are Muslim go back to their homes and they say it's not the same anymore. So there are ways to do this if we just use our heads. As long as you can recite the phrase La ilaha illa Allah, Muhammadur Rasul Allah, you can be a Muslim. You don't have to understand a single Arabic word in order to convert to Islam, and that's where the easy part ends. You might hear just before a homicide bomber explodes themselves, you might hear the phrase, Inshallah. That means if God wills, if Allah wills. And millions of people have been shaken to their very core in the last several years as they continue to hear the news stories grabbing the headlines around the world. It's almost as though some of these young fellows and young ladies try to see who can outdo each other with some outrageous act of violence. Maybe a mother and father flying from England to the United States. They fill their six-month-old baby's milk bottle with explosives and turn that child into a bomb in hopes of killing hundreds by blowing up the plane in midair. Physicians, doctors, driving highly explosive car bombs into the same hospitals in which they practice, bent on blowing up their plane, blowing up the same people that they worked with and practiced with, bent on killing the same patients they treated the night before, and killing the same colleagues they sipped coffee with on the previous morning. Students, born, bred, and educated in Western colleges, driven by some holy Islamic mission, plotting to kill their teachers and their government leaders and employers. So what do? We wait on the next attack of some sort that we will see. We're beginning to have to live more and more like the citizens of Israel. And they've done this for years. And that's why it is so important for us to do what we can to let our stance be known instead of trying to be wishy-washy about the thing and our government not letting people understand where we are. The modern world is a global community, and it gets that way more and more with more computers and more cyberspace. This declaration of war by us has not come from nationals of particular countries. These cowards, these reprobates, owe allegiance only to Muhammad's original ideology. They don't represent any country, don't wear the uniform of a country's armed forces. And you say to me, but Brother Bert, I thought we were here to learn about the Muslim religion, Islam. We are. What in the world do you think that Islam is? Sharia law, holy wars, those are their religions. That's what they do. They represent no country. They don't represent anybody else except themselves, and they are doctors dressed in white coats, mothers and fathers with babies wrapped in blankets, students wearing jeans. They may be, as we saw recently, all American Muslims waiting for the call from their radical cell leader. They have a ruthless disregard for any rules of war that have to do with the treatment of civilians. And the reason is simple. If you go back into some of the readings of Mohammed, there are no innocent civilians. Radical Islamists consider all people in or out of military uniform who do not believe in the original Islam of Mohammed to be the enemy till they convert or they're subject to Islamic law. And this is why they have to be stopped. This is why they have to be taught. They have to be converted. The civilized world, we have witnessed a holy war before. We've read about it in history. It was called the Crusades, and all that was a counterattack by Christians against holy warriors. I had a student of mine in the West Virginia School of Preaching, Alan, and he had lived for a year over in Jerusalem with his uncle. He said, that is the most messed up place religiously you've ever seen in your life. You've got the Jews, you've got the Muslims, and you have the Christians all claiming the same ground and fighting each other for every holy day that comes up. Radical Islam intends to conquer America. Now, this does not mean by us that they want the United States influence out of Palestine or out of Afghanistan or out of Pakistan or Saudi Arabia. That's not what it means. It means that they intend to conquer it. So, how do we become a Muslim? I just said it a while ago. La ilaha Allah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. That's all you need. There is no God but Allah, and I'm his messenger. Mohammed's his messenger, he's saying. The devout Muslims throughout the world, devout Muslims, they've been shocked just as we've been shocked and been horrified by the beheadings in Iraq and the murder of children in Beslan, as would any marginally civilized people. But modern Muslims also have been shocked at the atrocities that militants have committed in the name of Islam, because they will look all the way through that book, and it says that when two Muslims draw weapons against each other, they're at the brink of hell. And if one of them kills the other, they both enter it together. What a contradictory thing. As I mentioned to you today, the Islam that you believe in depends on what country you're in. And then you pick the parts out that you like. We hear of something called honor killings, which has not one bit of honor in it. Each year, untold numbers of women are killed by their relatives to preserve family honor. Women are killed for perceived immoral offenses, including marital infidelity. Here, the next one, allowing themselves to be raped, seeking divorces, or even failing to serve meals on time. Many of these killings, they go often unreported and unpunished. They occur in Muslim nations and in Muslim communities, in Western nations. Some claim that those who perpetuate these killings often use perverted Islamic concepts, and they use passages from the writings of the Quran to justify the practice. We studied in school that you can take little isolated parts of passages and do just about anything you like. I wrote an article one time about somebody cut off somebody's ear. And if you did some study on that, you would see who it was that did that and who was the person that got the ear cut off and what happened after that. But it took three passages, three accounts of the New Testament to find out what it was. I can make the Bible say just about what I'd like to, but if you read it in context, as they evidently don't, you would see that these things are not even near legal. The available statistics in honor killings are only the tip of the iceberg. The statistics do not show the number of female suicides that are provoked and engineered to cover up an honor killing. Neither do they show the number of mysterious disappearances of these sweet young ladies. Here recently, I saw one on television. All she wanted to do was get away and stay away from her parents here in the United States. I don't know what happened. I didn't know what would happen. But as long as the Muslims believe what the Quran says, at least some parts of Islam will attempt to advance its roles through non-peaceful means. If homicide bombers believe they will go to paradise, if they believe that they have received rewards for dying in a holy war with the United States, there's not a single thing that we can do to stop all the terrorism. Disagree with me. You tell me what we can do to stop all of this terrorism. Now, we can minimize it. But as long as Americans keep thinking these radical Muslims will somehow come to their senses and commit suicide to advance their cause, we'll never defeat them. What we cannot understand is this what life is all about to them? But if you overlook the religious aspect, at least from the Muslim viewpoint, if you overlook that, you have totally missed the fundamental parts of terrorism. If the religious dimension is neglected, you will never know when we can declare victory, because Islam is not only a religion, it's their life. How do you say this is the end of it? Russia, over there in Afghanistan, finally just left. We've been there how many? Over a decade. We will keep people there for years to come as, quote, trainers. How long will we keep it there? Now, I have a graduate degree in Middle Eastern history, and I should have known better. But we in the Lord's Church and we in the United States have a problem with patience. Me especially, that's probably my weakest area. I want to go up to someone and say, "Hi, do you believe in God?" "Yes." "Do you believe that he had a son who died for all of our sins?" "Yes." "I'd like to have you come down to the front with me and let me baptize you." It doesn't work that way. We have totally forgotten that it takes building relationships. Because, Brother Derek, evangelism takes time. It takes quite a bit of time. It's a slow process. Treasuring friendships, being there for them when they have a bad time of it and a good time of it, and letting them see that you live the same way. Have them come to you and ask biblical questions that we often take for granted. I talked to one fellow, I was studying with him, he was a Muslim. He said, "I don't like all that talk about blood and nails and cross and all this death stuff." Of course, the natural thing for me to say was read the newspapers and see who's doing what to whom. Most religious Americans see conversion to Christ as a good thing. But what is the cost of conversion to Christianity from Islam for a Muslim to Christianity? And it's not like our friends the Amish up fairly close to where I preached in Ohio for 3 years when I first moved up there. They talk about shunning. Oh, we don't know what shunning is until we see what happens when a person changes from being a Muslim to a Christian. The young lady that wrote the foreword for my book out there, she lived until she was 18 years of age in Pakistan. A sweet person. She's now the wife of a gospel preacher in Dalton, Georgia. But she said that when she was there, friends that she used to have prior to being a Christian would throw dirt and water and all and say, "We can't be around you anymore because you're a Christian." The cost of conversion to Christianity from a Muslim means loss of inheritance, loss of family, sometimes loss of life. All of these things just because they wanted to switch to the truth. And some still do. You know the Warsaw Ghetto during World War II? They were put there to keep them there, the Jews from Poland. These folks want a ghetto. They want to be placed in an area where even the national police can't go in, so they can run it from there and do exactly what they get ready to do from that ghetto. It's a different breed, totally different. We have to be gently firm about the Muslims' hesitation to convert, because besides the family connections and friendships that I said were all affected, Christians in Islamic countries may face torture. And then they don't have any family to turn to. They may face imprisonment or destitution. There's no home, no job, no land, no way to make any connection with anybody. And I'm so thankful that my Lord and His blessed word is open for all to see, that He can understand and stand the scrutiny of the examination of what's in His book. You see, the struggle between the West and radical Islam is not one that you'll find a compromise solution for. There is no compromise. It says in Surah 2, verse 193, chapter 2, 193, "And fight with them until there's no persecution, and religion should be only for Allah. But if they desist, there should be no hostility except against the oppressors." Guess who they are? That's us. You see, fundamentalist Islam's hatred presents and suggests something that we have that they don't. We have something that they come over here to get that they don't have in their own country. We can call it freedom. We can call it liberty. It's what enables us to live productive lives within a reasonable framework of justice. Our enemies would like to remake us in their own image, and all of our sophisticated weapons that we have cannot win the Islamic mindset that we face, because the joys that we have, the freedom that we enjoy, rest on the rule of law and the equality under the law, the individual rights, the group rights, private property, an independent judiciary. It contains all these things that our brilliant forefathers gave to us, and I want to see if we can keep it. And if we are so lackadaisical about it that we let them take over before the end of this century is out, we deserve it. In contrast, among the world's 81 Islamic states, it would be hard to find one of those characters, one of those principles I just mentioned. It would be hard to find even one of them being put into practice, because with few exceptions, Muslim countries are ruled by dictators. Now, you may not call them a dictator, but they're ruled by dictators and tribal lords who hold on to their positions for life. There are places that are so hard even for them to locate over in that part of the world. Devout Muslims are employing American democracy to try to destroy us. We bring them in, we invite them in, and then they use our freedoms to try to destroy us, but I don't think they have any chance. Suppose our enemies have come into the United States through immigration for the express purpose of organizing themselves politically. Our enemies have used our best character qualities against us, and we let them. And because of the way our Constitution is written, we have to, and we have to let that Constitution defeat them. In order to win this war, it's necessary to identify each element of the opposition and define its role. You always have to do that. In combat, if you don't define who your enemy is, you're dead. Number one, the devout Muslims. Number two, Muslim front organizations that work to silence any critique or criticism of themselves. Number three, enablers of Islamic education, those who write and supply and finance educational materials, Brother Derek, that have found their way into school systems and into libraries all over this nation. Number four, hate mongers who advocate violence, terror, and the overthrow of constitutional law in our country. And number five, the political correctness of the propaganda machine in the United States. Now, who are our immediate enemies? Number one, Muslim front organization. Number two, the enablers of Islamic education. Number three, and this is the big one, disbelief of the Islamic seriousness. Oh, they wouldn't do that. They are doing that. So what's the answer? What can we do? What's the future of this religion begun by Muhammad 600 years after we had already become a missionary religion? I want to approach the question very quickly on what we can do from this perspective. If we're going to have any chance of being successful in combating the spread of radical Islam, we have to do it as groups. Now, the group that you can go to, the group that you can see people that are in this community that have like-mindedness is called ACT with an exclamation mark after it, and I hope you'll write this down and use it on your computer, ACT for America. I told you I'd give you specific things. And you'll see people in this community, you'll see people all over the nation, you'll see groups that you can associate with so that they have websites that provide practical means and commentary to assist you in the fight against terrorism and to help with our national security. They can connect you with people in this community and provide you with educational materials for your distribution. And you will have people that will join you. And here are some simple tips. Contact your elected officials and voice your opinion on certain issues. Every call is counted and considered. You don't believe that, do you? How in the world do you think the White House and the government keeps tabs on the pulse of us? Every call is counted. Oh, by the way, the White House telephone number is this: 202-456-1111. You may be surprised who answers, not who you think, but a human being. I've tried it. Monitor your local newspapers. If it publishes any derogatory information on the United States, write a letter to the editor, but you're probably doing that already. If they don't respond, contact the paper's advertisers and tell the advertisers what the paper continues to do after you've brought to their attention the truth. People are prompted to action by threats that they perceive to be the most imminent to them and their families. So have your grassroots group that you can find in this area identify these threats. Maybe a local mosque, a regional mosque that distributes literature that advocates violence against infidels and the overthrow of our government. Folks, we have the power of technology. With a click of a button, and I've seen this happen. This is the way Allen works. I forgot he was a real person. Everything I get is done that quick. I mean, it's efficient. With the click of a button, you can send an email to 10, 100, or 1,000 people in your address book. That quick. Your Facebook. That email can be about a bill about to be voted on in Congress, a news story, an action alert. We have to get the information out there. We have the power of the dollar. Well, what's left of it? Withhold contributions to your alma mater. And I'm saying this to me standing a few feet from where mine is. As long as political correctness is permitted to run wild. You see, the United States is not just a geographical area. The United States is a spirit. And if we choose to look the other way or choose some material watered down, some position that is as diluted as it possibly can be, our grandchildren will demand why we didn't take action. And they'll have every right to do so. Today it's our watch. 50 years ago it was somebody else's watch. I hate to think of 10 years from now being the good old days of 2012. Wherever we live, whether it's here, we leave here and go some other place, we have to stop this rising tide of Islam. And we understand who the enemy is and how he thinks and how he operates and how he exploits our weaknesses to achieve his end. And we have to use every legitimate means, and we have laws all over the place where we can do this, but we don't use them. And so we have to educate. We have to inform everybody about this enemy. And we have to say enough to political correctness that demands that government officials and elected representatives do what's necessary to protect us. That's why they're called representatives. We have to win the public relations battle so that in the court of public opinion, we will be judged rightly if this comes to court. We have to resist this enemy because our very lives and our liberty depend on this. I hope that you're interested enough to grab every piece of information you can about this, and I hope that you don't think that I'm like Chicken Little to cry, saying the sky is falling. It's already started. You see what I mentioned to you the other morning about what's happened in Great Britain. They just let them in a little bit. They just let the Sharia courts deal with Muslim people's civic and domestic cases. That's all. I mean, we have to be politically correct, but that same thing has now happened in Amsterdam, the Netherlands, Sweden, France, in some places. And it'll continue as long as we let it. And all of a sudden, what we grew up in won't be the same anymore. It's coming pretty close to that at this point. I want to thank you again for what you've done this week. I have done my time that I'm supposed to, and I'm 1 minute over. So thank you very much for your attention.